I don't think I'm really interested. Please, let's just have another. Smiles. I'm about to repeat my tired protestation, but I can already hear him say, have another. I'm almost to the point of laughing. He sees my laugh, doesn't care where it's coming from. All he cares is I'm smiling. Now he's pouring himself one. Look, amigo, I hope you don't think I'm paying for these drinks. Little bourgeois me has finally spoken out. I know all about these mincing niceties that always, always end up taking advantage of foreigners. I didn't ask you to pay for the drinks, or, for that matter, to pay me. Ironically, he's not offended. He must have known this was coming, must have done it a million times, comes with the job, probably. Here, have another, in the name of friendship. Friendship? You have nothing to fear from me. I'm not sleeping with you. Maybe you won't. Maybe you will. The night is young, and I haven't given up. At which point he removes his cap and lets down so much hair that I couldn't understand how such a huge tumble could have been wrapped and tucked under so small a bonnet. He was a woman. Disappointed? No, on the contrary. The tiny wrists, the bashful air, the softest skin under the sun, tenderness that seemed to spill out of her eyes, not with the smirking boldness of those who've been around, but with the most heart-rending promises of utter sweetness and chastity in bed. Was I disappointed? Perhaps, because the sting of the situation had been dispelled. Out came a hand that touched my cheek and stayed there, as if to soothe away the shock and surprise. Better now? I nodded. You need another. And you do too, I said, pouring her a drink this time. I asked her why she purposely misled people to thinking she was a man. I was expecting it's safer for business, or something a bit more rakish, like for moments such as these. Then came a giggle, this time for real, as if she had committed a naughty prank, but was not in the least bit displeased or surprised by the result. But I am a man, she said. She was nodding away at my disbelief, as if the nod itself were part of the same prank. You're a man? I asked, no less disappointed than when I discovered she was a woman. I'm afraid so. With both elbows on the table, he leaned forward and almost touched my nose with the tip of his and said, I like you very, very much, Señor Alfredo. And you like me too, very, very much. And the beautiful thing is we both know it. I stared at him, at her, who knows? Let's have another, I said. I was going to suggest it, said my impish friend. Do you want me man or woman? He asked, as if one could scale one's way back up our phylogenetic tree. I didn't know what answer to give. I wanted to say, I want you as intermezzo. So I said, I want you as both, or as in between. He seemed taken aback. Naughty, naughty, he said, as though for the first time that night I'd actually managed to shock him with something thoroughly debauched. When he stood up to go to the bathroom, I noticed she was indeed a woman wearing a dress and high-heeled shoes. I couldn't help staring at the most lovely skin on her most lovely ankles. She knew she'd caught me yet once more and started to giggle in earnest. Will you watch my purse? She asked. She must have sensed that if she hadn't asked me to watch something of hers, I would probably have paid the bill and left the bar. This, in a nutshell, is what I call the San Clemente syndrome. There was applause, and it was affectionate applause. We not only liked the story, but the man telling the story.
Eviva il sindromo de San Clemente, said Straordinario Fantastico. Sindromo is not masculine, is feminine, la sindrome, corrected someone sitting next to her. Eviva la sindrome de San Clemente, hailed someone who was clearly aching to shout something. He, along with a few others, had arrived very late for dinner, crying in good Roman dialect, Lasseteci passare, let us through, to the restaurant owners as a way of announcing his arrival to the company. Everyone had long since started eating. His car had taken a wrong turn around Ponte Milvio. Then he couldn't find the restaurant, etc. As a result, he missed the first two courses. He was now sitting at the very end of the table, and he, as well as those he had brought with him from the bookstore, had been given the last of the cheeses remaining in the house. This, plus two flans for each, because this was all that was left. He made up for the missing food with too much wine.
He had heard most of the poet's speech on San Clemente. I think that all this clementizing is quite charming, though I have no idea how your metaphor will help us see where we are, what we want, where we are headed, any more than the wine we have been drinking, eh? But if the job of poetry, like that of wine, is to help us see double, then I propose another toast until we've drunk enough wine to see the world with four eyes. And then if we're not careful, with eight. Eviva! Interrupted Amanda, toasting to the latecomer in a desperate effort to shut him up. Eviva! Everyone else toasted. Better write another book of poems, and soon, said Straordinario Fantastico. Someone suggested an ice cream place not far from the restaurant. No, skip the ice cream place. Let's go for coffee. We all massed into cars and headed along the Lungotevere towards the Pantheon. In the car, I was happy, but I kept thinking of the Basilica and how similar to our evening, one thing leading to the next, to something totally unforeseen, and just when you thought the cycle had ended, something new cropped up, and after it, something else as well, until you realized you could easily be back where you started. In the center of old Rome. A day ago, we had gone swimming by the light of the moon. Now we were here. In a few days, he'd be gone. If only he'd be back exactly a year from now. I slipped my arm around Oliver's and leaned against Ada. I fell asleep. It was well past 1 a.m. when the party arrived at Café San Eustachio. We ordered coffees for everyone. I thought I understood why everyone swears by San Eustachio's coffee. Or perhaps I wanted to think I understood, but I wasn't sure. I wasn't even sure I liked it. Perhaps no one else did, but felt obliged to fall in with the general opinion, and claimed that they too couldn't live without it. There was a large crowd of coffee drinkers standing and sitting around the famed Roman coffee house. I loved watching all of these lightly dressed people standing so close to me, all of them sharing the same basic thing, love for the night, love for the city, love for its people, and an ardent desire to couple with anyone. Love for anything that would prevent the tiny groups of people who had come together here from disbanding. After coffee, when the group considered separating, someone said, "No, we can't say goodbye yet." Someone suggested a pub nearby. Best beer in Rome. Why not? So we headed down a long and narrow side alley, leading in the direction of Campo de Fiori. Lucia walked between me and the poet. Oliver, talking with the two sisters, was behind us. The old man had made friends with Straordinario Fantastico, and they were both confabulating about San Clemente. "What a metaphor for life," said Straordinario Fantastico. "Please, no need to overdo things, either with the clementification this and clementization that." "It was just a figure of speech, you know," said Falstaff, who probably had all his fill of his godson's glory for the night. Noticing that Ada was walking by herself, I walked back and held her by the hand. She was dressed in white, and her tan skin had a sheen that made me want to touch every pore in her body. We did not speak. I could hear her high heels tapping on the slate pavement. In the dark, she seemed an apparition. I wanted this walk to never end. The silent and deserted alley was altogether murky, and its ancient, pockmarked cobblestones glistened in the damp air, as though an ancient carrier had spilled the viscous contents of his amphora before disappearing underground in the ancient city. Everyone had left Rome, and the emptied city, which had seen too many and seen them all, now belonged to us alone, and to the poet who had cast it, if only for one night, in his own image. The mugginess was not going to break tonight. We could, if we wished, have walked in circles, and no one would have known, and none would have minded. As we ambled down an empty labyrinth of sparely lit streets, I began to wonder what all this talk of San Clemente had to do with us, how we moved through time. How time moved through us, how we change and keep changing and come back to the same. One could even grow old and not learn a thing about this. That was the poet's lesson, I presume. In a month or so from now, when I'd revisit Rome, being here tonight with Oliver would seem totally unreal, as though it had happened to an entirely different me. And the wish born 3 years ago, when an errand boy offered to take me to a cheap movie theater known for what went on there, would seem no less unfulfilled to me 3 months from now than it was 3 years ago. He came, he left. Nothing else had changed. I had not changed. The world hadn't changed. Yet nothing would be the same, and all that remains is dream-making and strange remembrance. The bar was closing when we arrived. "We close at 2. Well, we still have time for drinks. Oliver wanted a martini, an American martini. What a beautiful idea, said the poet. Me too, chimed in someone else. On the large jukebox, you could hear the same summer hit we'd heard during the entire month of July. On hearing the word martini, the old man and the publisher also dittoed the order. Ehi, tavaniere, shouted Falstaff. The waiter told us that we could either have wine or beer. The bartender had left earlier that evening, on account of because his mother was taken gravely ill to the hospital where she had been taken. Everyone smothered a laugh at the waiter's garbled speech. Oliver asked what they charged for martinis. The waiter yelled the question to the girl at the cash register. She told him how much. Well, what if I make the drinks and you charge us your price on account of because we can mix the drinks, we're mixing? There was a hesitation on the part of the waiter and of the cashier. The owner had long since left. Why not? Said the girl. If you know how to make them, faccia pure. Go ahead. Round of applause for Oliver, who sauntered his way behind the bar and in a matter of seconds after adding ice to the gin and a bit of vermouth, was vigorously shaking the cocktail mixer. Olives couldn't be found in the tiny refrigerator by the bar. The cashier came and checked and produced a bowl. Olives, she said, staring Oliver straight in the face as if to mean, it was under your very nose. Had you looked? And what else? Maybe I could entice you to accept a martini from us, he said. This has been a crazy evening. A drink could not possibly make it any crazier. Make it a small one. You want me to teach you? And he proceeded to explain the intricacies of a straight-up, dry martini. He was okay being the bartender to the bar's help. Where'd you learn this? I asked. Mixology 101. Courtesy of Harvard. Weekends I'd make a living as a bartender all through college. Then I became a chef, then a caterer, but always a poker player. His undergraduate years, each time he spoke of them, acquired a limelight, incandescent magic as if they belonged to another life, a life to which I had no access since it already belonged to the past. Proof of its existence trickled, as it did now, in his ability to mix drinks or to tell arcane grappas apart, or to speak to all women, or in the mysterious square envelopes addressed to him that arrived at our house from all over the world. I had never envied him in the past, nor felt threatened by it. All these facets of his life had the mysterious character of incidents that had occurred in my father's life long before my birth, but which continued to resonate into the present. I didn't envy life before me, nor did I ache to travel back to the time when he had been my age. There were at least 15 of us now, and we occupied one of the large wooden rustic tables. The waiter announced last call a second time. Within 10 minutes, the other customers had left. The waiter had already started lowering the metal gate on account of because it was closing hour of the chiusura. The jukebox was summarily unplugged. If each of us kept talking, we might be here till daybreak. Did I shock you? Asked the poet. Me? I asked, not certain why, of all people at the table, he should have addressed me. Lucia stared at us. Alfredo, I'm afraid he knows more than you know about corrupting youth. È un dissoluto assoluto, she intoned, as always now, her hand to my cheek. This poem is about one thing and one thing only, said Straordinario Fantastico. San Clemente is really about four, at the very least, retorted the poet. Third last call. Listen, interrupted the owner of the bookstore to the waiter, why don't you let us stay? We'll put the young lady in the cab when we're done, and we'll pay. Another round of martinis? Do as you please, said the waiter, removing his apron. He'd given up on us. I'm going home. Oliver came up to me and asked me to play something on the piano. What would you like? I asked. Anything. This would be my thanks for the most beautiful evening of my life. I took a sip from my second martini, feeling as decadent as one of those jazz piano players who smoke a lot and drink a lot and are found dead in a gutter at the end of every film. I wanted to play Brahms, but an instinct told me to play something very quiet and contemplative. So I played one of the Goldberg variations, which made me quiet and contemplative. There was a sigh among the 15 or so, which pleased me, since this was my only way of repaying for this magical evening. When I asked to play something else, I proposed a Capriccio by Brahms. They all agreed it was a wonderful idea until the devil took hold of me, and after playing the opening bars of Capriccio, out of nowhere I started to play Estornello. The contrast caught them all by surprise, and all began to sing, though not in unison, for each sang the Stornello he or she knew. Each time we came to the refrain, we agreed we'd all sing the same words, which earlier that evening Oliver and I had heard Dante the statue recite. Everyone was ecstatic, and I was asked to play another. then another. Roman stornelli are usually bawdy, lilting songs, not the lacerating, heart-wrenching arias from Naples. After the third, I looked over at Oliver and said I wanted to go out and take a fresh breath of air.
"What is it? Doesn't he feel well?" the poet asked Oliver.
"No, no, just needs some air. Please, don't move."
The cashier leaned all the way down and with one arm lifted up the rolling shutter. I got out from under the partly lowered shutter and suddenly felt a fresh gust of wind on the empty alley.
"Can we walk a bit?" I asked Oliver. We sauntered down the dark alley exactly like two shades in Dante, the younger and the older. It was still very hot and I caught the light from a street lamp glistening on Oliver's forehead. We made our way deeper into an extremely quiet alley, then through another, as if drawn through these unreal and sticky goblin lanes that seemed to lead to a different nether realm you entered in a state of stupor and wonderment. All I heard were the alley cats and the splashing of running water nearby. Either a marble fountain or one of those numberless municipal fontanelli found all over Rome.
"Water," I gasped.
"I'm not made for martinis. I'm so drunk."
"Yeah, well, you shouldn't have had any. You had scotch, then wine, then grappa, now gin."
"So much for the evening sexual buildup," he snickered.
"You look pale.
I think I'm going to be sick."
"Best remedy is to make it happen."
"How?"
"Bend down and stick your fingers all the way inside your mouth."
I shook my head. "No way."
"We found a garbage bin on the sidewalk.
Do it inside here."
I normally resisted throwing up, but I was too ashamed to be childish now. I was so uncomfortable puking in front of him. I wasn't even sure that Amanda had not followed us.
"Here, bend down. I'll hold your head."
I was resisting.
"No, it'll pass. I'm sure it'll pass."
"Open your mouth." I opened my mouth, and before I knew it, I was sick as soon as he touched my uvula. But what a solace to have my head held. What selfless courage to hold someone's head while he's vomiting. Would I have had it in me to do the same for him?
"I think I'm done," I said.
"Well, let's see if more doesn't come out." Sure enough, another heave brought on by more of tonight's food and drink.
"Don't you chew your peas?" he asked, smiling at me.
How I loved being made fun of that way.
"I just hope I didn't get your shoes dirty," I said.
"They're not shoes. They're sandals." Both of us almost burst out laughing. When I looked around, I saw that I'd vomited right next to a statue of the Pasquino. How like me to vomit right in front of Rome's most venerable lampoonist.
"I swear there were peas there that hadn't even been bitten into and could have fed children in India."
More laughter. I washed my face and rinsed my mouth with the water of a fountain we found on our way back. Right before us, we caught sight of the human statue of Dante again. He had removed his cape and his long black hair was all undone. He must have sweated 5 pounds in that costume. He was now brawling with the statue of Queen Nefertiti, also with her mask off and her long hair matted together by sweat.
"I'm picking up my things tonight, and good night and good riddance. Good riddance to you too, and vaffanculo. Franculo yourself, e poi t'inculo."
And so on. Nefertiti threw a handful of coins at Dante, who ducked the coins, though one of them hit him in the face.
"Aia!"
he yelped. For a moment I thought they were going to come to blows. We returned by another equally dark, deserted, glistening side alley, then onto Via Santa Maria dell'Anima. Above us was a weak square street light mounted to a wall of a tiny old corner building. In the old days they probably had a gas jet in its place. I stopped, and he stopped. "The most beautiful day of my life, and I end up throwing up." He wasn't listening. He pressed me against the wall and started to kiss me, his hips pushing into mine, his arms about to lift me off the ground. My eyes were shut, but I knew he had stopped kissing me to look around him. People could be walking by. I didn't want to look. I let him be the one to worry. Then we kissed again, and with my eyes still shut, I think I did hear two voices, old men's voices, grumbling something about taking a good look at these two, wondering if in the old days you'd ever see such a sight. But I didn't want to think about them. I didn't worry. If he wasn't worried, I wasn't worried. I could spend the rest of my life like this, with him at night in Rome, my eyes totally shut, one leg coiled around his.
I thought of coming back here in the weeks or months to come, for this was our spot. We returned to the bar to find everyone had already left. By then it must have been 3 in the morning, or even later. Except for a few cars, the city was dead quiet, when, by mistake, we reached the normally crowded Piazza Rotonda. Around the Pantheon, it too was unusually empty. There were a few tourists lugging huge knapsacks, a few drunks, and the usual drug dealers. Oliver stopped a street vendor and bought me a lemon soda. The taste of bitter lemons was refreshing and made me feel better. Oliver bought a bitter orange drink and a slice of watermelon. He offered me a bite, but I said no. How wonderful to walk half-drunk with lemon soda on a muggy night like this around the gleaming, slate cobblestones of Rome with someone's arm around me. We turned left and heading towards Piazza Febo, suddenly, from nowhere, made out someone strumming a guitar, singing not a rock song, but as we got closer, an old Neapolitan tune. Fanesta Caluciva. It took me a moment to recognize it, then I remembered. Mafalda had taught me that song years ago when I was a boy. It was her lullaby. I hardly knew Naples, and other than for her and her immediate entourage and a few casual visits to Naples with my parents, had never had contact with the Neapolitans. For the strains of the doleful song stirred such powerful nostalgia for lost loves and for things lost over the course of one's life and for lives, like my grandfather's, that had come along before mine, that I was suddenly taken back to a poor, disconsolate universe of simple folk like Mafalda's ancestors, fretting and scurrying in the tiny vicoli of old Naples, whose memory I wanted to share word for word with Oliver now, as if he too, like Mafalda and Manfredi and Anchise and me, were a fellow southerner whom I'd met in a foreign port city and who'd instantly understood why the sound of this old song, like an ancient prayer for the dead in the deadest of languages, could bring tears even in those who couldn't understand a syllable. The song reminded him of the Israeli national anthem, he said. Or was it inspired by the Moldau? On second thought, it might have been an aria from Bellini's Sonnambula. Warm, but still off, I said, though the song has often been attributed to Bellini. We're clementizing, he said. I translated the words from Neapolitan to Italian to English. It's about a young man who passes by his beloved's window only to be told by her sister that Nanella has died. From the mouth where flowers once blossomed, only worms emerge. Farewell, window, for my Nena can no longer look out again. A German tourist, who seemed all alone and quite drunk himself that night, had overheard me translating the song into English and approached us, begging in halting English to know if I could be so kind as to translate the words into German as well. Along the way to our hotel, I taught Oliver and the German how to sing the refrain, which all three of us repeated again and again, our voices reverberating in the narrow, damp alleys of Rome, as each mangled his own version of Neapolitan. Finally, we said goodbye to the German on Piazza Navona. On our way to our hotel, Oliver and I began to sing the refrain again, softly. Chianeva sempre cadormeva sola, mo dorme coli muerte accompagnata. She always wept because she slept alone. Now she sleeps among the dead. I can, from this distance of years now, still think I'm hearing the voices of two young men singing these words in Neapolitano towards daybreak, neither realizing, as they held each other and kissed again and again on the dark lanes of old Rome, that this was the last night they would ever make love again. Tomorrow let's go to San Clemente, I said. Tomorrow is today, he replied. Part 4. Ghost Spots. Anchise was waiting for me at the station. I spotted him as soon as the train made its prolonged curve around the bay, slowing down and almost grazing the tall cypresses that I loved so much and through which I always caught an ever-welcoming preview of the glaring mid-afternoon sea. I lowered the window and let the wind fan my face, catching a glimpse of our lumbering engine car far, far ahead. Arriving in B always made me happy. It reminded me of arrivals in early June at the end of every school year. The wind, the heat, the glinting gray platform with the ancient stationmaster's hut permanently shuttered since the First World War, the dead silence, all spelled my favorite season at this deserted and beloved time of day. Summer was just about to start, it seemed. Things hadn't happened yet. My head was still buzzing with last-minute cramming before exams. This was the first time I was sighting the sea this year. Oliver who? The train stopped for a few seconds. Let off about 5 passengers. There was the usual rumble followed by the loud hydraulic rattle of the engine. Then, as easily as they had stopped, the car squeaked again out of the station, one by one, and slithered away, in total silence. I stood for a moment under the dried wooden cantilever. The whole place, including the boarded hut, exuded a strong odor of petrol, tar, chipped paint, and piss. And as always, blackbirds, pine trees, cicadas. Summer. I'd seldom thought of the approaching school year. Now I was grateful that with so much heat and so much summer around me, it still seemed months away. Within minutes of my arrival, the Direttissimo to Rome swished in on the opposite track, always punctual, that train. 3 days ago, we had taken the exact same one. I remembered now staring from its windows and thinking, in a few days you'll be back, and you'll be alone, and you'll hate it, so don't let anything catch you unprepared. Be warned. I had rehearsed losing him, not just to ward off suffering by taking it in small doses beforehand, but, as all superstitious people do, to see if my willingness to accept the very worst might induce fate to soften its blow. Like soldiers trained to fight by night, I lived in the dark so as not to be blinded when darkness came. Rehearse the pain to dull the pain, homeopathically. Once again, then, view of the bay, check. Scent of the pine trees, check. Station master's hut, check. Sight of the hills in the distance to recall the morning we rode back to B and came speeding downhill, almost running over a gypsy girl. Check. Smell of piss, petrol, tar, enamel paint, check, 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 and check. And Kisei grabbed my backpack and offered to carry it for me. I told him not to. Backpacks were not made to be carried except by their owners. He did not understand why exactly, and handed it back to me. He asked if the Signora Oliva had left. Yes. This morning. Triste, he remarked. Yes. A bit. Anche a me duole. I, too, am saddened. I avoided his eyes. I did not want to encourage him to say anything, or even bring up the subject. My mother, when I arrived, wanted to know everything about our trip. I told her that we had done nothing special, just seen the capital and Villa Borghese, San Clemente. Otherwise, we just walked around a lot. Lots of fountains, lots of strange places at night. 2 dinners. Dinners? My mother asked, with an understated triumphant, see, I was right, wasn't I? And with whom? People. What people? Writers, publishers, friends of Oliver's. We stayed up every night. Not even 18 years old and already he leaves la ducha vita, came Mafalda's acid satire. My mother agreed. We fixed up your room the way it was. We thought you'd like to finally have it back. I was instantly saddened and infuriated. Who had given them the right? They'd clearly been prying, together or separately. I always knew I'd eventually have my room back, but I'd hoped for a slower, more extended transition to the way things used to be before Oliver. I'd pictured lying in bed, struggling to work up the courage to make it across his room. What I'd failed to anticipate was that Mafalda would have already changed his sheets. Our sheets. Luckily, I'd asked him again to give me billowy that morning, after I'd made sure he wore it all through our stay in Rome. I'd put it in a plastic laundry bag in our hotel room and would in all likelihood have to hide it from everyone's prying reach for the rest of my life. On certain nights, I'd remove billowy from its bag and make sure it hadn't acquired the scent of plastic or of my clothes and hold it next to me, flap its long sleeves around me, and breathe out his name in the dark. Oliva, Oliva, Oliva. It was Oliver calling me by his name when he'd imitate its transmogrified sound as spoken by Mafalda and Enkise. But it'd also be me calling him by his name as well, hoping he'd call me back by mine, which I'd speak for him to me and back to him. Elio, Elio, Elio. To avoid entering my bedroom from the balcony and finding him missing, I used the inner stairwell. I opened the door to my room, dropped my backpack on the floor, and threw myself on my warm, sunlit bed. Thank goodness for that, that they had not washed the bedspread. Suddenly I was happy to be back. I could have fallen asleep right then and there, forgetting all about Billowy and the smell and about Oliver himself. Who can resist sleep at 2 or 3 in the afternoon on these sunlit parts of the Mediterranean? In my exhaustion, I resolved to take out my scorebook later in the afternoon and pick up the Haydn exactly where I'd left off. Either this, or I'd head over to the tennis courts and sit in the sun on one of those warm benches that were sure to send a shiver of well-being through my body, and see who was available for a game. There was always someone. I had never welcomed sleep so serenely in my life. There'd be plenty of time for mourning, I thought. It will come probably on the sly, as I've heard those things always do, and there won't be any getting off lightly, either. Anticipating sorrow to neutralize sorrow, that's paltry, cowardly stuff, I told myself, knowing I was an ace practitioner of the craft. And what if it came fiercely? And what if it came and didn't let go, a sorrow that had come to stay and did to me what longing for him had done on those nights when it seemed there was something so essential missing from my life that it might as well have been missing from my body? So that losing him now would be like losing a hand you could spot in every picture of yourself around the house, but without which you couldn't possibly be you again. You lose it, as you always knew you would, and you were even prepared to, but you can't bring yourself to live with the loss. And hoping not to think of it, like praying not to dream of it, hurts just the same. Then a strange idea got a hold of me. What if my body, just my body, my heart, cried out for his? What to do then? What if at night I wouldn't be able to live with myself unless I had him by me, inside me? What then? Think of the pain before the pain. I knew what I was doing. Even in my sleep, I knew what I was doing. Trying to immunize yourself, that's what you're doing. You'll end up killing the whole thing away. Sneaky, cunning boy, that's what you are, sneaky, heartless, cunning boy. I smiled at the voice. The sun was right on me now. And I loved the sun with a near-pagan love for things of earth. Pagan, that's what you are. I had never known how much I loved the earth, the sun, the sea, people, things, even art seemed to come second. Or was I fooling myself? In the middle of the afternoon, I'd become aware that I was enjoying sleep, and not just seeking refuge in it. Sleep within sleep, like dreams within dreams, could anything be better? An access to something as exquisite as pure bliss began to take hold of me. This must be Wednesday, I thought. And indeed it was Wednesday, when the cutlery grinder set up his shop in our courtyard and begins to hone every blade in the household. Mafalda always chatting him up as she stands next to him, holding a glass of lemonade for him while he plies away at the whetstone. The raspy, fricative sound of his wheel crackling and hissing in the mid-afternoon heat, sending sound waves of bliss up my way to my bedroom. I had never been able to admit to myself how happy Oliver had made me the day he'd swallowed my peach. Of course it had moved me, but it had flattered me as well, as though his gesture had said, I believe with every cell in my body that every cell in yours must not, must never die, and if it does have to die, let it die inside my body. He'd unlatched the partly open door to the balcony from the outside, stepped in. We weren't quite on speaking terms that day. He didn't ask if he could come in. What was I going to say? Say, you can't come in? This was when I raised my arm to greet him and tell him I was done pouting. No more pouting, ever, and let him lift the sheets and get into my bed. Now, no sooner had I heard the sound of the whetstone amid the cicadas than I knew I'd either wake up or go on sleeping, and both were good, dreaming or sleeping. One and the same. I'd take either, or both. When I awoke, it was nearing 5 o'clock. I no longer wanted to play tennis, just as I had absolutely no desire to work on the Haydn. Time for a swim, I thought. I put on my bathing suit and walked down the stairway. Vimini was sitting on the short wall next to her parents' house. How come you're going for a swim? She asked. I don't know. I just felt like it. Want to come? Not today. They're forcing me to wear this ridiculous hat if I want to stay outside. I look like a Mexican bandit. Pancho Vimini, what will you do if I go swimming? I'll watch. Unless you can help me get onto one of those rocks, then I'll sit there and wet my feet and keep my hat on. Let's go then. You never need to ask for Vimini's hand. It was just given naturally, the way blind people automatically take your elbow. Just don't walk too fast, she said. We went down the stairway, and when we reached the rocks, I found the one she liked best and sat next to her. This was her favorite spot with Oliver. The rock was warm, and I loved the way the sun felt on my skin at this time of the afternoon. Am I glad I'm back, I said. Did you have a good time in Rome? I nodded. We missed you. We who? Me, Marzia? She came looking for you the other day. I said. I told her where you went. I repeated. I could tell the child was scanning my face. I think she knows you don't like her very much. There was no point in debating the issue. And nothing. I just felt sorry for her. I said you left in a great rush. Vimini was obviously quite pleased with her guile. Did she believe you? I think so. It wasn't exactly a lie, you know. What do you mean? Well, you both left without saying goodbye. You're right. We did. We didn't mean anything by it. Oh, with you I don't mind. But him I do. Very much. Why? Why, Elio? You must forgive me for saying so, but you've never been very intelligent. It took me a while to see where she was headed with this. Then it hit me. I may never see him again either, I said. No, you still might. But I don't know about me. I could feel my throat tightening, so I left her on the rock and began to edge my way into the water. This was exactly what I'd predicted might happen. I'd stare at the water that evening and for a split second forget that he wasn't here any longer, that there was no point in turning back and looking up to the balcony, where his image hadn't quite vanished. And yet, scarcely hours ago, his body and my body. Now he had probably already had his second meal on the plane and was preparing to land at JFK. I knew that he was filled with grief when he finally kissed me one last time in one of the bathroom stalls at Fiumicino Airport, and that even if on the plane the drinks and the movie had distracted him, once alone in his room in New York, he too would be sad again. And I hated thinking of him sad, just as I knew he'd hate to see me sad in our bedroom, which had all too soon become my bedroom. Someone was coming towards the rocks. I tried to think of something to dispel my sorrow and fell upon the ironic fact that the distance separating Vimini from me was exactly the same that separated me from Oliver. 7 years. In 7 years, I began thinking and suddenly felt something almost burst in my throat. I dove in the water. It was after dinner when the phone rang. Oliver had arrived safely. Yes, in New York. Yes, same apartment, same people, same noise. Unfortunately, the same music streaming from outside the window. You could hear it now. He put the receiver out the window and allowed us to get a flavor of the Hispanic rhythms of New York. 114th Street, he said. Going out to a late lunch with friends, my mother and father were both talking to him from separate phones in the living room. I was on the phone in the kitchen. Here, well, you know, the usual dinner guests. Just left. Yes, very, very hot here too. My father hoped this had been productive. This? Staying with us, explained my father. Best thing in my life. If I could, I'd hop on the same plane and come with the shirt on my back. An extra bathing suit, a toothbrush. Everyone laughed. With arms open, Cotto. Jokes were being bandied back and forth. You know our tradition, explained my mother. You must always come back, even for a few days. Even for a few days meant no more than a few days. But she'd meant what she'd said, and he knew it. Allora, ciao, Oliver, e un presto, she said. My father more or less repeated the same words, then added, Dunque ti passo, Elio. Vi lascio. I heard the clicks of both extension phones signal that no one else was on the line. How tactful of my father. But the all-too-sudden freedom to be alone across what seemed a time barrier froze me. Did he have a good trip? Yes. Did he hate the meal? Yes. Did he think of me? I had run out of questions and should have thought of better than to keep pounding him with more. What do you think? He said, as if fearing someone might accidentally pick up the receiver. Vimini sends her love. Very upset. I'll go out and buy her something tomorrow and send it by express mail. I'll never forget Rome so long as I live. Me neither. Do you like your room? Sort of. Window facing noisy courtyard, never any sun, hardly any room for anything. I didn't know I owned so many books, bed way too small. Wish we could start all over in that room, I said. Both leaning out the window in that evening, rubbing shoulders as we did in Rome. Every day of my life, I said. Every day of mine, too. Shirt, toothbrush, score, and I'm flying over, so don't tempt me either. I took something from your room, he said. What? You'll never guess. What? Find out for yourself. And then I said it, not because it was what I wanted to say to him, but because the silence was weighing on us. And this was the easiest thing to smuggle in during a pause. And at least I would have said it. I don't want to lose you. We would write. I'd call from the post office, more private that way. There was talk of Christmas, of Thanksgiving. Yes, Christmas, but his world, which until then seemed no more distant from mine than by the thickness of the skin Chiara had once picked from his shoulders, had suddenly drifted light years away. By Christmas, it might not matter. Let me hear the noise from your window one last time. I heard crackle. Let me hear the sound you made when... A faint, timid sound. On account of because there were others in the house, he said. It made us laugh. Besides, they're waiting for me to go out with them. I wished he had never called. I'd wanted to hear him say my name again. I'd meant to ask him, now that we were far apart, whatever happened between him and Chiara. I'd also forgotten to ask where he'd put his red bathing suit. Probably he had forgotten and taken it away with him. The first thing I did after our telephone conversation was go up to my room and see what he could possibly have taken that would remind him of me. Then I saw the unyellowed blank spot on the wall. Bless him. He had taken a framed, antique postcard of Monet's berm dating back to 1905 or so. One of our previous American summer residents had fished it out of a flea market in Paris 2 years ago and had mailed it to me as a souvenir. The faded, colored postcard had originally been mailed in 1914. There were a few hasty, sepia-toned scribbles in German script on the back, addressed to a doctor in England, next to which the American student had inscribed his own greetings to me in black ink. Think of me someday. The picture would remind Oliver of the morning when I first spoke out, or of the day when we rode by the berm pretending not to notice it, or of that day we'd decided to picnic there and had vowed not to touch each other. The better to enjoy lying in bed together the same afternoon, I wanted him to have the picture before his eyes for all time. His whole life, in front of his desk, of his bed, everywhere. Nail it everywhere you go, I thought. The mystery was resolved, as such things always are with me, in my sleep that night. It had never struck me until then, and it had yet been staring me in the face for 2 whole years. His name was Maynard. Early one afternoon, while he must have known everyone was resting, he had knocked at my window to see if I had black ink. He'd run out, he said, and he only used black ink, as he knew I did. He stepped in. I was wearing only a bathing suit and went to my desk and handed him the bottle. He stared at me, stood there for an awkward moment, and then took the bottle. That same evening, he left the flask right outside my balcony door. Any other person would have knocked again and handed it back to me. I was 15 then, but I wouldn't have said no. In the course of one of our conversations, I'd told him about my favorite spot in the hills. I'd never thought of him until Oliver had lifted his picture. A while after supper, I saw my father sitting at his usual place at the breakfast table. His chair was turned out facing the sea. On his lap were the proofs of his latest book. He was drinking his usual chamomile tea, enjoying the night, and next to him, 3 large citronella candles. The mosquitoes were out with a vengeance tonight. I went downstairs to join him. This was our usual time to sit together. I'd neglected him over the past month. Tell me about Rome, he said, as soon as he saw me ready to sit next to him. This was also the moment when he would allow himself his last smoke of the day. He put away his manuscript with something of a tired toss that suggested an eager, "Now we come to the good part," and proceeded to light his cigarette with a roguish gesture, using one of the citronella candles. So... there was nothing to tell. I repeated what I'd told my mother, the hotel, the capital, Via Borghese, San Clemente, restaurants. Eat well, too? I nodded. And drank well, too? Nodded again. Done things your grandfather would approve of? I laughed. No, not this time. I told him about the incident near the Pasquino. What an idea, to vomit in front of the talking statue. Movies, concerts? It began to creep over me that he might be leading somewhere, perhaps without quite knowing it himself. I became aware of this because as he kept asking questions remotely approaching the subject, I began to sense that I was already applying evasive maneuvers well before what was awaiting around the corner was even visible. I spoke about the perennially dirty, run-down conditions of Rome's plazas, the heat, the weather, the traffic, too many nuns, such and such a church closed down, debris everywhere, seedy renovations. And I complained about the people and the tourists and about the minibuses loading and unloading numberless hordes bearing cameras and baseball hats. Seen any of the inner private courtyards I told you about? I guess we'd failed to visit the inner private courtyards he had told us about. Paid your respects to Giordano Bruno's statue? He asked. We certainly did. Almost vomited there too that night. We laughed. Tiny pause. Another drag from his cigarette. Now. You two had a nice friendship. This was far bolder than anything I anticipated. Yes, I replied, trying to leave my yes hanging in midair, as though buoyed by the rise of a negative qualifier that was ultimately suppressed. I just hoped he hadn't caught the mildly hostile, evasive, seemingly fatigued yes and so in my voice. I also hoped, though, that he'd seize the opportunity of the unstated yes and so in my answer to chide me, as he so often did, for being harsh or indifferent or way too critical of people who had every reason to consider themselves my friends. He might then add his usual bromide about how rare good friendships were and that even if people proved difficult to be with after a while, still most meant well and each had something good to impart. No man is an island. Can't shut yourself away from others. People need people, blah, blah, blah. But I'd guessed wrong. You're too smart not to know how rare, how special what you two had was. Oliver was Oliver, I said, as if that summed things up. Parce que c'était lui, parce que c'était moi, my father added, quoting Montaigne's all-encompassing explanation for his friendship with Étienne de la Boétie. I was thinking instead of Emily Bronte's words, because he's more myself than I am. Oliver may be very intelligent, I began. Once again, the disingenuous rise in intonation announced a damning but hanging invisibly between us. Anything not to let my father lead me any further down this road. Intelligent? He was more than intelligent. What you two had had everything and nothing to do with intelligence. He was good, and you were both lucky to have found each other, because you, too, are good. My father had never spoken of goodness this way before. It disarmed me. I think he was better than me, Papa. I'm sure he'd say the same about you, which flatters the two of you. He was about to tap his cigarette, and in leaning towards the ashtray, he reached out and touched my hand. What lies ahead is going to be very difficult, he started to say, altering his voice. His tone said, we don't have to speak about it, but let's not pretend we don't know what I'm saying. Speaking abstractly was the only way to speak the truth to him. Fear not. It will come. At least I hope it does. And when you least expect it. Nature has a cunning way of finding our weakest spot. Just remember, I am here. Right now, you may not want to feel anything. Perhaps you never wished to feel anything. And perhaps it's not with me that you'll want to speak about these things. But feel something you did. I looked at him. This was the moment when I should lie and tell him he was totally off course. I was about to. Look, he interrupted, you had a beautiful friendship, maybe more than a friendship, and I envy you. In my place, most parents would hope the whole thing goes away or pray that their sons land on their feet soon enough. But I am not such a parent. In your place, if there is pain, nurse it. And if there is a flame, don't snuff it out. Don't be brutal with it. Withdrawal can be a terrible thing when it keeps us awake at night, and watching others forget us sooner than we'd want to be forgotten is no better. We rip out so much of ourselves to be cured of things faster than we should that we go bankrupt by the age of 30 and have less to offer each time we start with someone new. But to feel nothing so as not to feel anything, what a waste. I couldn't begin to take all this in. I was dumbstruck. Have I spoken out of turn? He asked. I shook my head. Then let me say one more thing. It will clear the air. I may have come close, but I never had what you had. Something always held me back or stood in the way. How you live your life is your business. But remember, our hearts and our bodies are given to us only once. Most of us can't help but live as though we've got two lives to live. One is the mock-up, the other is the finished version, and then there are all those versions in between. But there's only one, and before you know it, your heart is worn out, and as for your body, there comes a point when no one wants to look at it, much less wants to come near it. Right now, there's sorrow. I don't envy the pain, but I envy you the pain. He took a breath. We may never speak about this again, but I hope you'll never hold it against me that we did. I will have been a terrible father if one day you'd want to speak to me and felt that the door was shut or not sufficiently open. I wanted to ask him how he knew, but then how could he not have known? How could anyone not have known? Does mother know? I asked. I was going to say suspect, but corrected myself. I don't think she does. His voice meant, but even if she did, I'm sure her attitude would be no different than mine. We said goodnight. On my way upstairs, I vowed to ask him about his life. We'd all heard about his women when he was young, but I'd never had an inkling of anything else. Was my father someone else? And if he was someone else, who was I? Oliver kept his promise. He came back just before Christmas and stayed till New Year's. At first he was totally jet-lagged. He needs time, I thought. But so do I. He whiled away the hours with my parents mostly, then with Vimini, who was overjoyed to feel that nothing had changed between them. I started to fear we'd slip back to our early days, when, but for patio pleasantries, avoidance and indifference were the norm. Why had his phone calls not prepared me for this? Was I the one responsible for the new tenor of our friendship? Had my parents said something? Had he come back for me? Or for them? For the house, to get away? He had come back for his book, which had already been published in England, in France, in Germany, and was finally due to come out in Italy. It was an elegant volume, and we were all very happy for him, including the bookseller and B, who promised a book party the following summer. Maybe, we'll see, said Oliver after we stopped there on our bikes. The ice cream vendor was closed for the season, as were the flower shop and the pharmacy where we'd stopped on leaving the berm that very first time when he showed me how badly he'd scraped himself. They all belonged to a lifetime ago. The town felt empty. The sky was gray. One night he had a long talk with my father. In all likelihood they were discussing me, or my college plans, or last summer, or his new book. When they opened the door, I heard laughter in the hallway downstairs, my mother kissing him. A while later, there was a knock at my bedroom door, not the French windows. That entrance was to remain permanently shut then. Want to talk? I was already in bed. He had on a sweater and seemed dressed to go out for a walk. He sat on the edge of my bed, looking as uneasy as I might have seemed the first time this room was used to be his. I might be getting married this spring, he said. I was dumbfounded. You never said anything. Well, it's been on and off for more than 2 years. I think that's wonderful news, I said. People getting married was always wonderful news. I was happy for them. Marriages were good. And the broad smile on my face was genuine enough, even if it occurred to me a while later that such news couldn't possibly bode well for us. Did I mind? He asked. You're being silly, I said. A long silence. Will you be getting in bed now? I asked. He looked at me gingerly. For a short while, but I won't do anything. It sounded like an updated and far more polished version of later, maybe. So we were back to that, were we? I had an impulse to mimic him, but held back. He lay beside me, on top of the blanket, with his sweater on. All he had taken off was his loafers. How long do you think this will go on? He asked wryly. Not long, I hope. He kissed me on the mouth. But it wasn't the kiss after the Pasquino, when he'd pressed me hard against the wall on Via Santa Maria dell'Anima. I recognized the taste instantly. I'd never realized how much I liked it, or how long I'd missed it. One more item to log on that checklist of things I'd miss before losing him for good. I was about to get out from under the blanket. I can't do this, he said, and sprang away. I can, I replied. Yes, but I can't. I must have had iced razor blades in my eyes, for he suddenly realized how angry I was. I'd love nothing better than to take your clothes off and at the very least hold you, but I can't. I put my arms around his head and held it. Then maybe you shouldn't stay. They know about us. I figured, he said. How? By the way your father spoke. You're lucky. My father would have carted me off to a correctional facility. I looked at him. I wanted one more kiss. I could have seized him. By the next morning, things became officially chilly. One small thing did occur that week. We were sitting in the living room after lunch, having coffee, when my father brought out a large manila folder in which were stacked 6 applications accompanied with the passport photos of each applicant. Next, summer's candidates. My father wanted Oliver's opinion, then passed around the folder to my mother, me, and then another professor, who had stopped by for lunch with his wife. Also a university colleague, who had come for the same reason the year before. My successor, said Oliver, picking one application above the rest and passing it around. My father instinctively darted a glance in my direction, then immediately withdrew it. The same thing had occurred almost a year ago to the day before. Pavel, Maynard's successor, had come to visit that Christmas and on looking over the file had strongly recommended one from Chicago. In fact, he knew him very well. Pavel and everyone else in the room felt quite tepid about a young postdoc teaching at Columbia who specialized in, of all things, the pre-Socratics. I had taken longer than needed to look at his picture and was relieved to notice that I felt nothing. In thinking back now, I couldn't be more certain that everything between us had started in this very room during Christmas break. Is this how I was selected? He asked in a sort of earnest, awkward candor which my mother always found disarming. I wanted it to be you, I told Oliver later that evening, when I helped him load his things in the car minutes before Manfredi drove him to the station. I made sure they picked you. That night, I riffled through my father's cabinet and found the file containing last year's applicants. I found his picture. Open shirt collar, billowy, long hair, the dash of a movie star unwillingly snapped by a paparazzo. No wonder I stared at it. I wished I could remember what I'd felt on that afternoon exactly a year ago. That burst of desire followed by its instant antidote. Fear. The real Oliver and each successive Oliver wearing a different colored bathing suit every day, or the Oliver who lay naked in bed, or who leaned on the window ledge of our hotel in Rome, stood in the way of the troubled and confused image I had drawn of him on first seeing his snapshot. I looked at the faces of the other applicants. This one wasn't so bad. I began to wonder what turn my life would have taken had someone else shown up instead. I wouldn't have gone to Rome. I might have gone elsewhere. I wouldn't have known the first thing about San Clemente. But I might have discovered something else which I'd missed out on and might never know about. Wouldn't have changed. Would never have been who I am today. Would have become someone else. I wonder now who that someone else is today. Is he happier? Couldn't I dip into his life for a few hours, a few days, and see for myself, not just to test if this other life is better, or to measure how our lives couldn't be farther apart because of Oliver, but also to consider what I would say to this other me were I to pay him a short visit one day? Would I like him? Would he like me? Would either of us understand why the other became who he is? Would either be surprised to learn that each of us had in fact run into an Oliver of one sort or another, man or woman, and that we were very possibly, regardless of who came to stay with us that summer, one and the same person still? It was my mother, who hated Pavel and would have forced my father to turn down anyone Pavel recommended, who finally twisted the arm of fate. We may be Jews of discretion, she said, but this Pavel is an anti-Semite and I won't have another anti-Semite in my house. I remembered that conversation. It too was imprinted on the photo of his face. So he's Jewish too, I thought. And then I did what I'd been meaning to do all along that night in my father's study. I pretended not to know who this chap Oliver was. This was last Christmas. Pavel was still trying to persuade us to host his friend. Summer hadn't happened yet, Oliver would probably arrive by cab. I'd carry his luggage, show him to his room, take him to the beach by way of the stairway down the rocks, and then, time allowing, show him around the property as far back as the old railway stop, and say something about the gypsies living in the abandoned train cars bearing the insignia of the Royal House of Savoy. Weeks later, if we had time, we might take a bike ride to B. We'd stop for refreshments. I'd show him the bookstore. Then I'd show him Monet's berm. None of it had happened yet. We heard of his wedding the following summer. We sent gifts, and I included a little mo. The summer came and went. I was often tempted to tell him about his successor and embroider all manner of stories about my new neighbor down the balcony. But I never sent him anything. The only letter I did send the year after was to tell him that Viminia died. He wrote to all of us saying how sorry he was. He was traveling Asia, so that by the time this letter reached us, his reaction to Vimini's death, rather than soothe an open sore, seemed to graze one that had healed on its own. Writing to him about her was like crossing the last footbridge between us, especially after it became clear that we weren't ever going to mention what had once existed between us, or, for that matter, that we weren't even mentioning it. Writing had also been my way of telling him what college I was attending in the States, in case my father, who kept an active correspondence with all of our previous residents, hadn't already told him. Ironically, Oliver wrote back to my address in Italy, another reason for the delay. Then came the blank years. If I were to punctuate my life with the people whose bed I shared, and if these could be divided into two categories, those before and those after Oliver, then the greatest gift life could bestow on me was to move this divider forward in time. Many helped me part life into before X and after X segments. Many brought joy and sorrow. Many threw my life off course, while others made no difference whatsoever, so that Oliver, who for so long had loomed like a fulcrum on the scale of life, eventually acquired successors who either eclipsed him or reduced him to an early signpost, a minor fork in the road, a small, fiery Mercury on the voyage out to Pluto and beyond. Fancy this, I might say. At the time I knew Oliver, I still hadn't met so-and-so, and yet life without so-and-so was simply unthinkable. One summer, 9 years after his last letter, I received a phone call in the States from my parents. You'll never guess who's staying with us for 2 days. In your old bedroom, and standing right in front of me now. I'd already guessed, of course, but I pretended I couldn't. The fact that you refuse to say you've already guessed says a great deal, my father said with a snicker before saying goodbye. There was a tussle between my parents over who was to hand their phone over. Finally, his voice came through. Elio, he said. I could hear my parents and the voices of children in the background. No one could say my name that way. Elio, I repeated, to say it was I speaking, but also to spark our old game, to show I'd forgotten nothing. It's Oliver, he said. He had forgotten. They showed me pictures. You haven't changed, he said. He spoke about his two boys who were right now playing in the living room with my mother, 8 and 6. I should meet his wife. I'm so happy to be here. You have no idea, no idea. It's the most beautiful spot in the world, I said, pretending to infer that he was happy because of the place. You can't understand how happy I am to be here. His words were breaking up. He passed the phone back to my mother, who, before turning to me, was still speaking to him with endearing words. Ma se tutto commosso. He's all choked up, she finally said to me. I wish I could be with you all, I responded, getting all worked up myself over someone I had almost entirely stopped thinking about. Time makes us sentimental. Perhaps, in the end, it's because of time that we suffer. 4 years later, while passing through his college town, I did the unusual. I decided to show up. I sat in his afternoon lecture hall, and after classes, he was putting away his books and packing loose sheets into a folder. I walked up to him. I wasn't going to make him guess who I was, but I wasn't going to make it easy, either. There was a student who wanted to ask him a question, so I waited my turn. The student eventually left. You probably don't remember me, I began, as he squinted somewhat, trying to place me. He was suddenly distant, as if stricken by the fear that we had met in a place he didn't care to remember. He put on a tentative, ironic, questioning look, an uncomfortable, puckered smile, as if rehearsing something like, I'm afraid you're mistaking me for somebody else. Then he paused. Good God, Elio! It was my beard that had thrown him off, he said. He embraced me, and then patted my furry face several times, as if I were younger than I'd even been that summer so long ago. He hugged me the way he couldn't bring himself to do that one night when he stepped into my room to tell me he was getting married. How many years has it been? 15. I counted them on the way here. Then I added, actually, that's not true. I've always known. 15 it is. Just look at you. Look, he added, come for a drink. Come for dinner. Tonight. Now. Meet my wife, my boys. Please, please, please. I'd love to. I have something to drop in my office and off we go. It's a lovely walk along the parking lot. You don't understand. I'd love to, but I can't. The can't did not mean I wasn't free to visit him, but that I couldn't bring myself to do it. He looked at me as he was still putting away his papers in the leather bag. You never did forgive me, did you? Forgive? There was nothing to forgive. If anything, I'm grateful for everything. I remember good things only. I'd heard people say this in the movies. They seemed to believe it. Then what is it? He asked. We were leaving his classroom and stepped into the commons where one of those long, languorous autumnal sunsets on the East Coast threw luminous shades of orange over the adjoining hills. How was I ever going to explain to him or to myself why I couldn't go to his home and meet his family, though every part of me was dying to? All of her wife, all of her sons, all of her pets, all of her study, desk, books, world, life. What had I expected? A hug? A handshake? A perfunctory, hail fellow well met? And then the unavoidable, later? The very possibility of meeting his family suddenly alarmed me. Too real, too sudden, too in my face, not rehearsed enough. Over the years, I'd lodged him in the permanent past, my pluperfect lover. Put him on ice, stuffed him with memories and mothballs like a hunted ornament, confabulating with the ghost of all my evenings. I'd dust him off from time to time and then put him back on the mantelpiece. He no longer belonged to Earth or to life. All I was likely to discover at this point wasn't just how distant were the paths we'd taken, it was the measure of loss that was going to strike me. A loss I didn't mind thinking about in abstract terms, but which would hurt when stared in the face. The way nostalgia hurts long after we've stopped thinking of things we've lost and may never have cared for. Or was it that I was jealous of his family? Of the life he'd made for himself? Of the things I never shared and couldn't possibly have known about? Things he had longed for, loved, and lost, and whose loss had crushed him, and whose presence in this life, when he'd had them, I wasn't there to witness and wouldn't know the first thing about. I wasn't there when he'd acquired them. Wasn't there when he'd given them up. Or was it much, much simpler? I had come to see if I felt something, if something was still alive. The trouble was, I didn't want anything to be alive either. All of these years, whenever I thought of him, I'd think of either B or of our last days in Rome, the whole thing leading up to two scenes, the balcony with its attendant agonies and Via Santa Maria dell'Anima, where he'd pushed me against the old wall and kissed me, and in the end, let me put one leg around his. Every time I go back to Rome, I go back to that one spot. It is still alive for me, still resounds with something totally present, as though a heart stolen from a tale by Poe still throbbed under the ancient slate pavement to remind me that here, I had finally encountered that life that was right for me, but had failed to have. I could never think of him in New England. When I lived in New England for a while and was separated from him by no more than 50 miles, I continued to imagine him as stuck in Italy somewhere, unreal and spectral. The places where he'd lived also felt inanimate, and as soon as I tried thinking of them, they too would float and drift away, no less unreal and spectral. Now, it turned out, not only were New England towns very much alive, but so was he. I could have easily thrust myself on him years ago, married or unmarried, unless it was I who, despite all appearances, had all along been unreal and spectral myself. Or had I come with a far more menial purpose, to find him living alone, waiting for me, craving to be taken back to be? Yes, both of our lives on the same artificial respirator, waiting for that time when we'd finally meet and scale our way back to the Piave Memorial. And then it came out of me. The truth is, I'm not sure I can feel nothing. And if I'm to meet your family, I would prefer not to feel anything. Followed by a dramatic silence. Perhaps it never went away. Was I speaking the truth? Or was the moment, tense and delicate as it was, making me say things I'd never quite admitted to myself and could still not wager were entirely true? I don't think it went away, I repeated. So, he said. His so was the only word that could sum up my uncertainties, but perhaps he had also meant, so? As though to question what could possibly have been so shocking about still wanting him after so many years. So, I repeated, as though referring to the capricious aches and sorrows of a fussy third party who happened to be me. So that's why you can't come over for drinks? So that's why I can't come over for drinks. What a goose! I'd altogether forgotten his word. We reached his office. He introduced me to two or three colleagues who happened to be in the department, surprising me with his total familiarity with every aspect of my career. He knew everything. He had kept abreast of the most insignificant details. In some cases, he must have dug out information about me that could only be obtained by surfing the web. It moved me. I'd assumed he'd totally forgotten me. I want to show you something, he said. His office had a large leather sofa. Oliver's sofa, I thought. So this is where he sits and reads. Papers were strewn about the sofa and the floor, except for the corner seat, which was under an alabaster lamp. Oliver lamp. I remembered sheets lining the floor of his room in B. Recognize him? He asked. On the wall was a framed, colored reproduction of a poorly preserved fresco of a bearded Mithraic figure. Each of us had bought one on the morning of our visit to San Clemente. I hadn't seen mine in ages. Next to it on the wall was a framed postcard of Monet's Berm. I recognized it immediately.